Welcome to episode 60 of Paper Talk, a monthly series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio. And I teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. Today I'm talking with Kathy Baker, who received her BA in Art History from the University of Michigan and then moved to the UK in 1968, where she eventually became the paper conservator for the Courtauld Institute Galleries in London. She talks about how handling the old papers in the documents she was preserving sparked her interest in paper.
Beautiful, absolutely gorgeous, incredibly forgiving no matter what you did to it. It was just so resilient.
When she returned to the U.S. in 1978, she taught at the State University of New York's Cooperstown Buffalo Graduate Program in Art Conservation, and she also received an M.A. in Art History from Syracuse University, where she wrote her thesis on The Birds of America. Between 1993 and 2004, Kathy published her first book, By His Own Labor, The Biography of Dard Hunter, and received an MFA in Book Arts in 2000 and a PhD in Communication Studies in 2004, both from the University of Alabama. We talk about the process of writing the biography of Dard Hunter, which involved moving into his home in Chillicothe, Ohio, which his grandson now owns. In 2005, Kathy joined the University of Michigan Library as a senior conservator of paper and books, which she retired from in 2016. In 2010, Kathy published From the Hand to the Machine, 19th Century American Paper and Mediums, Technologies, Materials, and Conservation, under her imprint, The Legacy Press, which she founded in 1997. The Legacy Press publishes award-winning books about the history and technologies of papermaking, printing, and bookbinding. Enjoy our conversation.
Well, Kathy Baker, welcome to Paper Talk.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you, and I'm looking forward to hearing about your journey with paper. So when did that begin?
So I went to college at the University of Michigan and from 63 to 67 and got a BA in art history.
Okay.
But in 63, the Beatles became very popular and mm-hmm. I became a total Anglophile. And vowed that when I graduated, as soon as I graduated, that I would move to England forever.
Uh-huh.
That didn't quite happen. I graduated and then actually was a lecturer at the Toledo Museum of Art in Toledo, Ohio for almost a year. And by that time, I had paid off my minuscule student loan and gathered about $200 and basically left my job. My job ended on a Friday in June at 5 o'clock, and at 7 o'clock at the Detroit Metro Airport, I was on a Pan Am flight one way to London. It took me, I worked for a reprint publishing company for 2 years in a little village called Farnborough in Hampshire. That got taken over by an American company and I was made redundant and had to go look for a new job. And I went to the Courtauld, which is the art history department of the University of London, and extremely prestigious. I didn't really realize that at the time. And asked for a job teaching art history. And the man just laughed at me. I just said, you have a BA from an American college in art history. What do you think you know? And of course, I didn't know very much. But he did get me a job in the technology department. And I didn't understand at the time that, as I said before, that it was the restoration department.
Right.
And so that just turned out to be an incredible fluke. I don't know. I know a very few people who were who would have been hired as a secretary, who would have been given an opportunity by their boss to just start working on paintings without any really prior experience at all.
And what about like working in England? That wasn't an issue? You could just get a job?
Oh, no, no, no. Before I left the United States, I had contacted this reprint publishing company, Greg International Publishers in Farnborough, and told them that I wanted to come to England and I wanted a job. And they said, well, basically, if you show up, we'll consider giving you a job. And so they ended up doing that. I got a basically a residence work permit for that specific job. And so I held that job for 2 years. And then, as I said, I was made redundant. So when I went to the courtauld, the registrar, who's the person who did all the hiring, said, well, if you want this job, working in the technology department, what we'll do is you can start tomorrow and we'll pay you under, probably shouldn't be saying this, but it was a long time ago. We'll pay you under the table and until your work permit for this specific job is available. And so I did that. I think it took about 2 months for the work permit to come through. And eventually, after 4 years of working in the UK, I was then eligible to become sort of what we would call here a permanent resident, somebody on a green card.
Right.
And so I could come and go from the country as I wanted to. And I also didn't have to get a visa to go back into the United States. So that worked out really well. And I ended up staying for 10 years.
Okay. And did you see the Beatles perform?
No, I have never, ever seen any of the Beatles do anything live, unfortunately. But to get back to my involvement with paper, when I was working as the secretary for Mr. Rees Jones at the courtauld, I shared an office with the paper conservator.
Oh.
And she worked only half a day every day. And so she did all of her work on a long table right in front of me. And the more I watched her interact with drawings, all old master drawings from the Courtauld Institute drawings collection, Witt collection of drawings, fabulous collection, very, very little known at the time. The more I realized that I was far more interested, I can't say at that time I was far more interested in paper over paintings, but what really inspired me about her work was that she could get through so many more things in a given amount of time than you can if you're working on a painting.
Mm-hmm.
So that really, I thought that really suited my personality more. I mean, I wasn't a terribly patient person back then. I have since learned to be patient.
Uh-huh.
And eventually she went to the Tate Gallery and headed up the first paper conservation lab at the Tate. Her name is Kasia Zielinski. I hope she's still alive. She's from Poland. And eventually I took over her job working full-time on the Witt collection of old master drawings. And I did that until 1978 when I finally came back home to the States.
Ah, so can you tell us about a particular drawing that you restored just to give us a sort of a glimpse into paper restoration?
I have to say that when I was working at the Courtauld, Kasia was a very conservative conservator.
Mm-hmm.
And actually the mission of her, what started out to be her work and then which I basically took over, was to rehouse this collection of drawings, which I think then was about 5,000 drawings. that had been purchased by Sir John Witt over a relatively long period of time, from mostly from dealers, and they were very badly matted in acidic matte board. And basically what she did was to just remat things, just take them off the old mats, do whatever remedial work was needed to be able to safely put the drawing into a new mat, which is why she got through things so fast.
Right.
And so basically when she left, that's all I really did. So I worked on thousands of drawings over a relatively short period of time. And I have to know, I knew absolutely zero about paper then. It wasn't until many years later, about till 76, I think it was, when I finally read Dard Hunter's book, Papermaking, the History and Technique of an Ancient Craft, when I actually started to understand that there was a lot more about paper than just what I was handling day in and day out.
Right, but what you were handling were handmade sheets.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Everything was handmade. Yeah. I didn't work. I worked on a few late 19th century Impressionist drawings by Cezanne and Matisse, and because Samuel Courtauld himself was a great collector of Impressionist and Post-Impressionist artwork. And so when I resigned my position to go back to the States, I gave plenty of months of notice, and the curator finally thought, oh my God, she isn't going to be here for very long, or maybe I better get her to work on the most important drawings in that collection, which included these late 19th century, mid to late 19th century papers, which were far more difficult to work on than the old master drawings on handmade, you know, linen rag paper. Beautiful, absolutely gorgeous, incredibly forgiving no matter what you did to it. It was just so resilient. And I wish I had known then what I know now about paper. It just would have been such an incredible experience to handle those pieces of paper, knowing far more about them and being able to pay attention to them. I remember when I first noticed the rib shadows along the chain lines in a drawing, I thought I had done something in a treatment which caused those.
Oh.
And I was terribly concerned. And I went to my boss and said, what? These lines have suddenly shown up. I didn't notice them before. What has caused it? He had no clue because he was basically a paintings conservator. And, you know, eventually I found out that was fine, you know. And then I began to realize that all of the paper that I was handling had those same lines on it. I just don't know why it took me so long to actually see it.
Oh, that's so interesting. So those are the laid lines and the chain lines from the handmade, from the mold that they were created on that are visible.
Well, not those so much, but the shadows on either side of the the chain lines caused by the ribs underneath and indirect contact with the screen.
Yep. Got it. Wow. Okay. So then what caused you to go back to the States, and what did you do next?
Well, I had been in England from 68 to 78, and in early 78, I began to realize that I was really, really homesick. Mm-hmm. Nobody could tell that I was an American. I had completely passed for a Brit. And yet I felt like I was constantly in a play. Where I had to act out this persona, which was really deep down not me. It was fun to do. It was fun to sort of fool everybody. Not that that was my real intention, but I just wanted to fit in, you know.
Right. So the most So your language, did you speak like a Brit?
Oh, absolutely. Oh,
okay. Okay.
Oh, yeah. And I used to drive my family crazy when I would come back home for vacations or holidays. Uh-huh. And they would, you know, oh, you're so hoity-toity. And, and then strangers would love that I had this incredible British accent, you know. And I think Americans are still, I mean, a Brit can say virtually anything. It's just how they say it that, you know, seems to matter, which annoys the hell out of me. But anyway, anyway, I got very homesick. Mm-hmm. By that time, I was teaching a mini course to the paintings conservation students in paper. And I took them to Hale Mill every year to let them see how paper was actually made by hand. Now, Simon Green does not remember this at all, and he, for a long time, refused to acknowledge that, in fact, I ever did that.
Interesting.
But because he said we never allow anybody in the mill, you know. Never did.
Right, and just describe Hale Mill and Bartram Green briefly for listeners who might not.
So Hale Mill was owned by the Green family from, I think, early 1800s, 1805. I should know this because Maureen Green has written a book about the history of Hale Mill, and I published it, but it's been a while. But early in the 19th century, they established this mill in Maidstone in Kent, called Hale Mill. And Simon Green, who's still alive and well, and living with his wife Maureen in Maidstone.
And he was on my podcast, so listeners could listen to that.
Yeah. Really, really a really interesting character. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, he had to, because of economic reasons, had to sell the mill. I believe it was in the 80s, 1980s. And I think he's just now divesting himself of most everything that was in the mill. A lot of it is going to a man called Mark Crocker, I think, north of Liverpool, who's setting up a paper museum. Which is fantastic that all this material didn't just, you know, go into a dumpster someplace.
Right. But you're saying he sold the mill, but it closed, correct?
Oh, it's closed. Yeah. Well, I shouldn't say he sold the mill. He didn't sell the mill. He closed the business.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's okay.
So the property was turned into apartments, condos, sort of arrangements. And you can still go visit the property and see the mill pretty much the way it looked for most of the 19th century and into the 20th century. But anyway, we visited the mill, and I actually got to pull sheets of paper from vat number 3 or 5, I don't remember, with Norman, and I'm not remembering his last name. That was such a thrill. I mean, it was a very big mold, and it took a lot more strength than I had thought before I actually made these first sheets myself. And the students were just in awe of this, the way the paper was made, as was I. And that, I think that's when I really started thinking that I need to learn a lot more about what paper is. I thoroughly enjoyed teaching. And I thought, well, maybe I should go back to the States and see if I can get a teaching job. Mm-hmm. And it just worked out really well that the director of the Cooperstown graduate program in conservation, located in Cooperstown, New York, was looking for a paper person to teach the paper conservation courses. And I applied. I went over there, I think the winter of 77, interviewed. She gave me a job offer, and I started teaching there in the fall of 78. And that was really when I started learning about paper, was when I was having to teach it, which every teacher knows that that's true. A good teacher learns a lot more through the act of teaching, mm-hmm. Because you should question yourself, whatever comes out of your mouth, you should say, is that really true? Or, is that really what I observe? Or am I making that up? Or am I just repeating what somebody else said? Or,
Right. Whatever. And at this point in time, could you even study paper conservation? I mean, I know you had the 10 years experience and that's how you got that job, but
Could I have learned it? Yes, actually, okay. NYU, mm-hmm. their conservation program started in 1960, I believe.
Okay.
But I'm not sure how strong their paper conservation course. Most of these courses started, the early ones, especially in the States, focused on paintings conservation. Mm-hmm. And sort of paper and objects were a little bit on the sideline. Certainly in the 60s, well, I didn't even learn about conservation. I certainly didn't learn about conservation when I was taking art history
right.
at the University of Michigan. I mean, nobody mentioned it, to my knowledge. It was only when I went to work at the Toledo Museum of Art that I met Richard Buck, who told us about the ICA program at Oberlin College. That I suddenly realized that conservation really was what I wanted to do. I didn't really see the point of having a degree in art history. Mm-hmm. I actually started Michigan as a pre-med student. I was going to go into medical technology, mm-hmm. flunked out of that, and so I had to choose something else, and so I went into art history. But I always had this real interest in science, particularly chemistry and physics, and then how that works out with art history. And of course, that really is the definition of conservation. So, but in 68, when I left to go to England, going to NYU, it was so expensive. And it really did not seriously cross my mind. And uh-huh. I wanted to go to England so badly.
Right.
That I decided that I would rather give up the idea of conservation rather than give up the idea of going to England. So to get into the Courtauld was right. just a total, how wow. could that possibly happen? It was just so incredible.
Meant to be, yeah. yeah. Wow. Okay, so you were at Cooperstown.
So I was at Cooperstown. I taught paper conservation there. I ended up teaching in the program even after it moved to Buffalo. It's now the Buffalo State College graduate program in conservation. It has a longer name than that, but I can't remember what it is. I taught there from 78 to 93. Mm-hmm. So for 15 years, I taught paper conservation. I decided to leave for a couple of reasons. I felt enough feedback from the students. They weren't asking new questions. Mm-hmm. So I thought I was getting very stale in terms mm-hmm. of what I could impart to them and what I was also getting back from them or being able to expand my own knowledge. And at that point in time in 92, 93, the opportunity to work on the Dart Hunter biography came up. And so I had to make this choice between, do I want to go on teaching or do I want to concentrate on really getting immersed in this this icon in our field?
Right. So let's just explain who Dart Hunter is. And I don't know the story about how this opportunity came up, so you can wrap that in too.
Well, Dart Hunter was an American paper historian. He's written many, many books. He died in 1966. He was born in 1883 mm-hmm. in Steubenville, Ohio, and lived most of his life in Chillicothe, Ohio, where the family home still is. And Hunter actually started out very early in life as a Roycroft artist. He worked for the Roycrofters in East Aurora, New York, and was an incredible designer and craftsperson.
Yeah.
And then he discovered on a trip to Vienna the history of letter forms, particularly of typefaces. He finally did some printing by himself. He eventually decided on a side trip to London in 1911, I think it was, that he really wanted to know a lot more about the history of papermaking and to do a lot more letterpress printing and type founding. Mm-hmm. And he came back to the States and basically set up a little paper mill and produced a number of, eventually moved to Chillicothe, Ohio, and, where he had a studio and produced a number of really fine limited edition books about the history of papermaking all around the world. And he traveled all around the world,
right,
on many trips, looking at how people made paper firsthand. So he, knowing as a paper maker, he brought something to that experience, which very few people to that point had ever done. And so he wrote two autobiographies, and both of them are relatively inaccurate, but very funny, very humorous writer. And anyway, in, I forget exactly when it was, but Hunter died in 66. His son, Dard Hunter Jr., died in, I want to say, 89. I might not be totally accurate about that date. And a woman called Patricia Scott, who was an art historian at Ohio University in Athens, mm-hmm, was writing a biography of Dard Hunter. And she, maybe I shouldn't say this out loud. Oh, all right. I've already started up better. she did not have, she had no support from Dard Hunter Jr. about this biography, because he didn't see how she could write anything new. If she didn't have, what we found out later, she didn't have access to all of the archive that was in the house. And he had no intention of giving her access to any of that. Mm. He also had just published a 2-volume limited edition work called The Life and Work of Dard Hunter, and about his father. And he had a lot invested in that economically. And he didn't, I don't think he really wanted to have sort of a competitive,
right,
book written about his father, mm-hmm, which would be essentially incomplete at best. And so when she actually died before he did, in the same year of cancer, she had a terrible bout with cancer, mm-hmm, and died. And then he died a few months later, I believe. And
was he ill also?
He had a long history of heart disease.
Okay.
And so he died of heart failure.
Okay.
Not terribly surprisingly, but still, he was a relatively young man. He was in his early 70s, I believe.
Okay.
Dard the Third, who was just a kid then, called me up in Buffalo to tell me that his father had died, and would I please let the membership of the Friends of Dard Hunter know that. And I asked him if I could go to the funeral, and he said, oh yes, please come. And I was living in Buffalo at this time.
Okay, let's just explain. The Friends of Dard Hunter is a group that formed when Dard,
right,
the First passed away, and he had amassed this collection. And, well, you tell,
yes,
you'll tell it better.
Well, the thing that Dard Hunter the First was most proud of that he had accomplished in his life was this amassing of a huge collection centered around paper and, mm-hmm, the paper and book arts. which included paper, printing, not so much binding. And in 1939, he had more or less given that collection to MIT.
Right.
And he served as the curator of that collection with the help of his son, Dart Hunter Jr. He had two sons, but Cornell was not terribly involved in any of this stuff, which he wanted to be, but wasn't. The family basically moved to Boston, to Cambridge, to be where the collection was, and they published a number of books while there. Hunter gave lectures, there was quite a large space which was donated to the collection within the library. The library was then rebuilt somewhere else, and the collection was moved into this other space. But by the 50s, the whole everything sort of changed administratively within universities and certainly within the paper industry, more towards administrators rather than scholars or people who would come up through the trade. Mm-hmm. And the administration at MIT just didn't see this collection as being relevant at all, just a huge drag financially. And so eventually they sold the collection to the Institute of Paper Chemistry in Appleton, Wisconsin. And the entire collection was moved to Appleton, where it languished in a basement and sub-basement for 4 years. Mm. In the early, I think it was 1980, at an American Institute for Conservation meeting in, I think it was San Francisco, a group of people got together, conservators primarily, mm-hmm. paper conservators, got together and decided to form the Friends of the Dart Hunter Paper Museum to act as an advocate for the collection, because we felt that it was being sort of ignored mm-hmm. by the Institute of Paper Chemistry, the IPC. And that it, you know, it could just molder away, literally.
Right.
We were chartered in 1981 at the next AIC meeting, which was in Philadelphia, and the group became a formal nonprofit group. Tim Barrett was the first president. Then Howie Clark became president, and then I became president. A whole succession of people after that. It's had a rather checkered career. I don't remember exactly when, but eventually the entire institute changed its name and moved from Appleton, Wisconsin, to become part of Georgia Tech University in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And a brand new building was built for the Institute of Paper Chemistry. It renamed itself the Institute of Paper Science and Technology. It now has another name. I think it's the Institute for Renewable Bioproducts or something like that. The museum was brought front and center. And so when you walked into the main building, the museum space was right there, right off the lobby. It was a rather small space. The bulk of the collection was held at another location, and you could access that as a scholar, but it wasn't open to the general public. This was in 87, I believe, and it became clear that Friends of the Dart Hunter Paper Museum no longer needed to be called that because it wasn't really acting as an advocate for the museum anymore. The museum, we felt, was on pretty good basis, foundation, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. for the first time in a very long time. And so it changed its name to the Friends of Dart Hunter. only within the last year, I think it is, it's changed its name to, and I'm not going to remember what it is, North American Paper Makers?
North American Hand Paper Makers.
North American Hand Paper Makers. And I have to say, for one, I'm very, very happy about that. Because the Friends of Dart Hunter to other people doesn't mean anything.
Right.
And this far better reflects what the organization has evolved into. So I was very pleased that name change was made.
Yeah, so I want to interject and just say that the North American Hand Paper Makers is now, it's a group of paper makers primarily in North America, and they have an annual meeting and a membership program, and it's no longer centered around Dart Hunter's collection. As you say, that mission was accomplished, but Dart Hunter's collection is at Georgia Tech in Atlanta, and this museum is open to the public, and you can go in and see. And as a scholar or researcher, you can also make appointments and see the archives.
Yes, and the library for the Institute was rather extensive, and over the last few years, the larger library, not the library belonging to the paper collection, was moved out of the building and dispersed among other campus libraries. And so that left a very large empty space, and all of the collection was then moved into that space. So now the museum is at one end of the building and the collection is at the other end of the building.
Yeah.
And so now there is a great leadership now. Virginia Howell is the director, and mm-hmm. people like Ann Frailson are volunteers, and they're, you know, sorting things out, and that was very much needed.
So
it seems like that's definitely moving in the right direction.
Hey listeners, let's take a little break here, and I want to tell you about The Paper Studio, my free Facebook group that has been evolving over the past several years. I'm re-energizing it in 2020 to include a monthly paper challenge. It's also a place to share what you're working on, get encouragement when you need a little push, be inspired with new ideas, tips, and tricks, all having to do with paper, of course. Join us by going to Facebook and searching for the group, The Paper Studio. Now back to the episode.
So you wrote the biography of Dart Hunter.
So yes, so Tim and I ended up going to the funeral of Dart II. And at that time, there were two people, I don't remember their names, my memory is not as good as it used to be, or maybe there's just more stuff up there.
They were
looking for someone to take over Patricia Scott's biography project. They had been sort of willed her notes and her manuscript and a few books mm-hmm. that she had collected. And they contacted me because I was the president, and they said, could you please put out a notice in the newsletter that we're looking for an author to complete this work? And I kept thinking, gee whiz, you know, I'm due a sabbatical. And this was something I'd really be interested in doing. And so at the funeral, at the time of the funeral, not at the funeral, I asked Dart III if he would have any objection to my taking over Patricia Scott's project. Mm-hmm. And he just didn't hesitate for a single second. He said, absolutely, I can't think of anybody better to do it than you. And Tim was right there, and he agreed. I'm not sure, actually, all that happened in exactly that way, but eventually that's what happened. So I ended up taking a sabbatical, a year sabbatical, and thought that I would be doing most of my research in Buffalo, because Dart III, by that time, was living, well, he's always living in a mountain house in the Hunter home in Chillicothe, Ohio. He only knew of a couple of boxes of documents that his father had used to write his limited edition biography. Mm-hmm. And so he, I came down to Chillicothe, picked those up, took those back to Buffalo. Then I got a call from Dard III, and he said, you need to come down here this weekend. So I came down, and he said, okay. So we have good news and bad news. The good news is that he was very interested in historic preservation at that time. Mm-hmm. This was in 91 or 92. And he had been going through the house, just making sure that it wasn't going to fall down, mm-hmm. and been finding all over the house bundles of papers wrapped in brown paper and string. Mm-hmm. And when he just kind of ignored them for a little while because he thought they might be old bills or whatever.
Right.
And eventually began to realize that there was this quite extensive archive of his grandfather's correspondence and drafts for his books and photographs and everything that in fact his father had seen and gone through, which is why his father knew that Patricia Scott could never write the biography that mm-hmm. she thought she would be able to, because she wouldn't have access to all this material. So he wrote and he said, so Kathy, there's all this material. The problem is that it's not in any kind of order at all.
Right.
And so eventually what happened was that I moved down to Chillicothe for the rest of my sabbatical. I did not live in the house. I lived in a rented room. Mm-hmm. And I went to Mountain House every day and went through all the bundles and sorted everything chronologically, which took months and months and months and months.
Yeah.
Put things in files and bought a used file cabinet to store all this stuff in. And the end of my sabbatical came, and I really hadn't really started doing anything yet because I've been spending all my time doing all of this basically archival work, which was a lot of fun. But so when I got back to teaching in 92, I had, if you're given a sabbatical, you have to agree to come back and teach for at least 1 year.
Okay.
Which is good because nobody would come back and have to do that. And that last year, 92, 93, was actually one of the best years that I had teaching for a number of other reasons that won't concern us now. But I was still torn between, am I going to go on teaching or I really need to devote full time to the Dard Hunter Project.
Right.
And so I put in my resignation to be effective at the end of the first semester in 93. And when that was over, I actually spent the summer still in Buffalo because I did a lot of research in East Aurora, New York, which is only 15 miles down the road. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I did most of the preparation research for Hunter's life as a Roycrofter then. But eventually, I think in the early fall, I moved into Mountain House. Dard III wrote me and said, would you like to come and live in the house? And I just like, oh, of course.
You know, yeah.
Like, who wouldn't want to live in the house?
Right.
And so I lived there from the fall of 93 until the summer of 96. So I was there for almost 3 years. And I lived in Dard Hunter's senior's first mm-hmm. bedroom. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much where I slept, and I watched television, and I did all my research, and that's where my computer was. Dard III was extremely generous, and he gave me access to basically anything in the house, which included using Dard Hunter's type to print Christmas cards on one of the hand presses. I mean,
wow.
it was just incredible. Absolutely
right.
incredible.
Right.
I met Dard Hunter's ghost once. That was an interesting experience. I'm not kidding. I actually did.
Well, do you want to share what happened?
Well, I was in bed. Uh-huh. I had gone to bed, and I was sort of dozing, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I sensed that there was someone else standing next to the bed. Mm-hmm. But it didn't, this didn't frighten me at all. Mm-hmm. And it sat down on the bed. And mm-hmm. as soon as it kind of sat down, it realized that I was there. And it just, you know, and then it disappeared.
Wow.
And I very much had the feeling that that was Dar the First.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
I mean, maybe I was just, you know.
Right.
Probably. I don't know what.
Yeah. Anyway. No, interesting.
And I also was in my closet one day when there was no one else in the house. And I heard very clearly someone call for Kathy. And I shouted, "I'm up here in the closet." Uh-huh. And thinking that Dart had come back.
Right.
From wherever he was. And then when he didn't come up stairs, I went down and he didn't come back for another 2 or 3 hours. So that was kind of weird,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But living in the house was just an incredible experience. And Darth and I became very, very good friends.
Mm-hmm.
It was not easy, if he ever listens to this podcast. It wasn't easy. I don't think it was easy for either one of us at certain points in time, because I was reading, every day I was reading letters. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what I discovered in the letters were things that contradicted what Hunter had written about himself or had done or had said. And I, at first, I was very enthusiastic to bring this to Dard's attention. And he would just get incredibly upset
mm-hmm.
Because this was not the story that he had been told by his father about his father.
Right.
And so after a while, I stopped doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think my biography really is, it's a great story. About a really, really interesting man.
Right.
Whom, of course, I never met. And Dart the Third never met either, because his grandfather died 2 years before he was born.
Okay.
But it was just a wonderful experience.
Yeah, what a fantastic experience to be able to walk in the shoes, in a way, live in the house,
write
the biography. So what's the title of the book?
The book is called By His Own Labor, The Biography of Dart Hunter. You wrote on the pre-notes that you met me at Dudenay mm-hmm. while I was doing some fundraising, and that I'm pretty sure that was for the Dart Hunter Biography Project. Mina and Sue Gosen were just fabulous in their support of my project. I had zero income, and they helped me fundraise and were able to channel donations to the project through them as a nonprofit, and then they sort of basically subcontracted me to write this biography. And that totaled over $20,000 over a year or so.
Right.
And that kept me going for years and years and years. So I will always be grateful to Dudenay for their support.
That's great. That's fantastic. Okay, so you went to graduate school again. I think you already had, did you have a master's before? No.
Yes.
You did?
Yes. Another long story, but I'll make it very quick. In order to get tenure at the University of at Buffalo State College, I had to get a terminal degree.
Okay.
And the terminal degree in conservation is an MA. But even though I was teaching conservation, I did not have a degree in conservation. So in order to, with my experience, I had to get another terminal degree, and the easiest one to get was an MFA. So I, in 84 and 85, while I was still living in Cooperstown, New York, I commuted to Syracuse University and ended up getting an MA in art history instead of an MFA in book arts.
Okay.
even though I had done all the coursework except for a few courses in book arts, the new dean, when I finished all my coursework, decided that the department that I was affiliated with had no right to give an MFA, and she would not grandfather me in. Mm. So I ended up getting not a terminal degree.
Oh, no.
My dean at the college was like,
yeah,
what's going on? So I got the director of the Courtauld Institute of Art to write a letter or give me a certificate saying that I had fulfilled the certificate requirements for an MA level in conservation.
Okay.
So with my MA in art history and my equivalent MA in conservation, they did give me tenure eventually. So, but when I was at Syracuse, I took courses in bookbinding, letterpress printing, and paper making, and also fine printing, as well as a few art history courses and an archives records course, which actually turned out to be very useful. Who knew? So I did get an MA in art history at Syracuse. So fast forward to, I finished the manuscript of the Dart Hunter book on April the 15th, 1996. Text.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
By that time, Steve Miller, who was teaching papermaking and printing at the University of Alabama in the MFA book arts program there, had already talked to me about his publishing the biography, my biography. So when I was finished writing the manuscript, I really wanted to be physically involved in the limited edition printing of my book. So I moved to Tuscaloosa, Alabama in the summer of 96 and spent about a year cutting the manuscript down by half because it was very long. I think it should have been published in its entirety, but anyway. Well, a number of things happened within the book arts program, and I decided, and I asked Steve Miller if I could be involved in the printing, and he said no. Basically, nicer than that, but no, because you really don't know anything about printing. Well, I actually had done a little bit of letterpress printing in Syracuse, but admittedly, not very much. And so I thought, well, if I go to the book arts program and you're my teacher, then you can't say that anymore. So I decided to do that. I decided to become a student in the MFA program at Tuscaloosa and started in the fall of 97.
Okay.
And that's when the Legacy Press was established because we each had to have a press name.
Okay.
So for the next 3 years, I published a small series of books, which I printed by hand, never on handmade paper, mostly on Mohawk Superfine, actually, which is a fabulous printing paper.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, I graduated in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And in 98, I think it was, Steve and I started to print the Dart Hunter Biography Project, which took us about a year and a half, with a lot of concentrated effort going on in the summer of 99, where we came in every single day during the summer and printed all day, every day.
Right. And this was a limited edition?
This was a limited edition.
Okay.
I think we printed 150 or 60 copies.
Right.
It's a very long book. It's over 350 pages.
Right.
All of the type was set at the Bixlers in Skinny Atlas, New York.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing was a complete collaborative effort. Gray Perot in Maine did the binding.
Mm-hmm.
Stan Nelson cut a few special characters for us,
mm-hmm.
and Type founded those. Judy Conant made all the boxes. Dard Hunter III had paper made on his grandfather's molds, big molds that were used as the end papers in the book. What else? John DePaul cut a two-color portrait of Dard Hunter for the frontispiece. And I'm probably forgetting a few people, but oh yes, and Twinmacher handmade paper made all of the paper for 4,000 sheets.
Okay, so this is all on handmade paper.
This is
as all opposed on to the paper. Other the books you were describing. Okay,
yeah, right.
Wow.
So, and that was published in, I think we put the date of 2000. So it had a nice little MM on the
right. And I'm just curious how you were funding your life at that point. You got a fellowship or something?
Yes. I was very, very fortunate to get a Jacob Javits Fellowship.
Okay.
Which was $100,000 to support my MFA project. Mm-hmm. A lot of that went into not only paying me a stipend, but also to buy materials. My master's thesis was on John DePaul, a fabulous wood engraver who's unfortunately died in 2004. But, I had to make polymer plates for that book.
Right.
It was a substantial book.
Yeah,
and I had to make process 400 polymer plates, and the material for that was just incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
I started doing a PhD even before I graduated from the MFA program, and so I got permission to roll the rest of the fellowship money into supporting me while I was doing my PhD. So I actually never had to borrow any money. I had a part-time job as a secretary to a program called Discovery in Alabama, which is a public television program, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Mm-hmm. I did actually quite well considering.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, so then how did the trade publication come about? And let's talk about the Legacy Press. You are a publisher now, and we're going to wind down in 10 or 15 minutes.
Okay. So once the limited edition was published, Steve and I went to talk to Bob Fleck at Oak Knoll Press to find out whether he was interested in doing the trade edition. And he basically, without even looking at it, said yes.
Okay.
So it's basically a facsimile edition. In other words, all the original letterpress printed pages were photographed and then turned into offset plates that were then offset printed. So the trade edition came out in March of 2000, and the limited edition came out in January of 2000. I should say that the collaborators in the limited edition project all said that they would just waive being paid until Steve made it, because this was done by Steve and the Red Hydra Press. So this wasn't done by me at all.
Right.
I was just the printer's devil. He pre-sold the book and accumulated enough money, I think it was $100,000 from the pre-sale, and paid everybody.
Wow. Yeah.
And so that was great.
Yeah.
So everything on top of that was just gravy.
Yeah.
And so we felt like we could go ahead he felt like he could go ahead and have the trade edition done.
Mm-hmm.
And that sold for, I think it was $49.95. I'm not terribly happy with that edition. I think it's not well produced, but you know.
How many copies were produced?
Did they do?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Okay.
They said it was the largest run that they had ever done, but I don't know.
Right.
I have no idea how many copies they made. A few years later, I did buy 600 copies that they were going to remainder, thinking that I could sell them better than they could. I couldn't do that either, so I ended up getting rid of those books to both Dard the Third, who I think still has copies, and sort of wholesale remainder
right
a bookseller. But if you can find a copy, it's worth reading, I think.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I have a copy. So you had started the Legacy Press, and now tell us what the Legacy Press is doing and how you transitioned into.
Yeah, so the Legacy Press started in 1997. Mm-hmm. All of the books that I did for the first 3 years were all hand-printed. And then I moved from Tuscaloosa to Ann Arbor, Michigan, where I live now, in 2005, and hadn't done any printing at all. I hadn't really done anything with books, except I was writing my own book, From the Hand to the Machine. And in 2007, I published a book by Dorothy Field, which is a wonderful, wonderful book, which did not sell very well, unfortunately. Called Paper Threshold. I decided not to have any more books that were hand-printed. I really wanted people to read my books. Mm-hmm. I wanted them to be priced in a way that they would actually be able to afford reading them. And so the only way to do that was to offset print them. And I found printing letterpress printing extremely challenging, but extremely time consuming and a lot of physical effort, which didn't appeal to me very much. I realized that what I really enjoyed was editing and mm-hmm. designing books. So I decided to, with the Legacy Press, to focus on those two things. So from 2007 until now, I've published the Legacy Press books, and it's the Legacy Press. Mm-hmm. Legacy Press is something, another press.
Okay.
And at first it was, you know, I did Dorothy's book in 2007. I did Elaine Koretsky's book on papermaking in China, which is an incredibly good book, in 2009. In 2010, I published my own book. And then I started increasing the amount of books that I was doing each year. And now I'm doing between 4 and 5 books a year. I retired from the university. I joined the conservation lab at the University of Michigan Library, for worked there for 10 years, and then retired almost exactly 4 years ago, and have been basically concentrating on publishing books. The Legacy Press focuses in on printing paper and the bookbinding arts. So it centers around the production technologies that go into producing books. I personally am probably a lot more interested in paper than in printing or binding. Mm-hmm. Paper doesn't exist in the abstract. I mean, it's used, and right. I think when it's used for printing and drawing, you could argue, it has a very special relationship with the media on it. And I'm always interested in seeing these connections between different technologies.
Yeah, so I want to hear a little bit about how the production of a book, like how many copies you print, are you doing all the marketing?
Right. I do all of, I actually now do everything. Mm-hmm. The print run really depends on what the subject is, what I think the market is. Mm-hmm. I used to have huge print runs. So the unit cost of the books were relatively low, but that, except for one book, Books Will Speak, playing by my friend Julia Miller, which is a complete runaway bestseller. Mm-hmm. Everything else didn't really sell as well. The market wasn't as big mm-hmm. As I thought it was going to be. Right. I think it's actually quite big, but not a lot of people buy books within that market. So. So right now I'm far more conservative, and I usually my print run is between 200 and 500 copies. Okay. And most of them around 200 copies. I can always reprint a book, if I run out. And, I'm happy to say that Tim Barrett's book on European hand paper making was sold out, 500 copies in 7 months.
Wow.
So that's been reprinted as a second edition in a soft cover, which is selling quite well.
Good.
A book that I did last year called Mooring a Field, which is about the education of library and archives conservators, sort of history of that field. That's almost sold out as well. So I think this strategy that I'm using now is far more reasonable. And because I only really base the cost of my books on what I pay somebody else to do. In other words, my own time is never taken into consideration. I did have a distributor. I've had a distributor of one sort or other. Since I started doing this in 2007. But last year, almost exactly a year ago, my distributor went bankrupt and owing me $16,500, and which I'll probably never recoup. And so I've had to take over all of the distribution. So I now rent storage space and have my inventory in storage space and do all the packing and shipping from the house.
And where are your books printed?
They were printed in Dexter, Michigan, which is about a 20-minute drive from here. They were the parent company that owned the distributor, so they went bankrupt too.
Okay.
They were bought by a big company out of Minnesota. They had another printer a little bit farther down the road called Sheridan Books in Chelsea, Michigan. And so I now have my books printed by them. They're very, very good. Both of those printers were very, very good.
Yeah. And are they offset printed or digital?
Yes.
Offset.
They're both.
Oh, both.
They offer both. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. And so what, do you have a couple of new books on the horizon?
Or? So by the end of this month, volume six of the very successful series, Swell Mechanicals, the history, essays on the history of bookbinding, that will go to the printer. I'm working on Peter and Donna Thomas's bibliography of their entire press output, which is prodigious.
Yeah.
That's a lot of fun because a lot of great images of a lot of little books. I'm going to be publishing this year also Theodore Peterson's unpublished work on Coptic bindings at the Morgan Library in New York. That work has never been published. It was finished in 1950 and has just been known through crappy Xeroxes ever since then. So that was quite a coup to get that contract. Russell Merritt, I'm publishing his book this year. A collection of essays that he's written on private press or fine press printers and typography and all things sort of typographic. And there are a couple of other things.
Wow. And so do you get proposals from people or do you request proposals? I imagine it's a combination.
It's a combination.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I go to meetings, I meet people and I think if they, you know, have something to offer. In fact, that's how Russell Merritt's book came about, as I met him at the Dart Hunter meeting, APHA meeting I guess it was 2 years ago in Iowa City and said, you know, if you ever feel like writing a book, I'd be really happy to publish it. So, and then sometimes people would just write me sort of out of the blue. So I'm also doing a series now that just started with volume one last year, Papermaker's Tears, that Tatiana Ginsburg is editing for me. And we're working on volume two right now and maybe into volume three. So, Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
I just got a copy of that book and I love it. So Papermaker's Tears. And then you also published Amy Lee's book on Hanji.
Hanji Unfurled, right? And so, she's writing another book for me, which will be out in a couple of years. Mm-hmm. So lots of exciting books coming down the pike. And this is just heaven to me to sit here and you know, unfortunately I'm in front of the computer all day long. I need to get out and walk more. Right. I love what I do, and that's wonderful. I mean, if you can say that, it's wonderful.
Yeah. Well, fantastic, Kathy. Well, thanks for coming on, and thanks for all you've contributed to the field.
I mean, it's been really, my pleasure, really.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for asking me. I love talking. If you hadn't gathered that.
Yeah. Well, it's great having you on.
Thanks.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon. The reason besides the season.